Picture a 5-year-old girl slashed in the face by a stranger, a trauma that could have defined her life in darkness. Instead, the extra kindness adults showed her created an accidental delusion. She believed she was extraordinary. That misunderstanding became her secret weapon. This is how Tina Fey's journey began, proving that sometimes our wounds and misconceptions become the very things that propel us forward. Her memoir, Bossy Pants, isn't just a celebrity tell-all. It's a masterclass in turning life's absurdities into fuel for success. From suburban Pennsylvania to the pinnacle of comedy, Fey's story reveals how embracing your weirdness, rather than fighting it, might be the most revolutionary act of all. Growing up with a Korean War codebreaker father who looked like Clint Eastwood gave Tina the gift of anxiety, the fear of getting in trouble, knowing you're loved but definitely not above the law. This wasn't helicopter parenting, it was understanding that actions have consequences and nobody's rescuing you from your mistakes. Her mother's puberty education was spectacularly unhelpful. When 10-year-old Tina wanted to shave her legs, she received a My First Period kit with pamphlets like Growing Up and Liking It. She got her period while singing Neil Diamond's Song Song Blue at a chorus concert, a comedic collision that taught her life rarely gives you what you ask for, but what you get makes a better story. The real education came at 13, when she watched her teenage cousin critique a passing girl's hips. Fey realized women's bodies face endless scrutiny, infinite physical deficiencies women are expected to correct. Rather than surrender to this impossible standard, she weaponized self-deprecating humor, turning potential vulnerabilities into punchlines before anyone else could. In 1976, Larry Wentzler's Summer Showtime Youth Theater became Fey's refuge after romantic rejection. She found acceptance among costume designers, actors, and 2 25-year-old lesbians named Karen and Sharon, with whom she spent evenings playing Celebrity, a game she jokes was developed by NASA to keep girls virgins well into their 20s. The contrast with school was stark. Her health teacher, Mr. Garth, devoted an entire class to spotting and avoiding homosexuals, claiming they'd trick ya by discovering what music and candy you liked. When Fey suggested he meant child molesters, not homosexuals, he stared at her hands, not unlike a dog. Her second year brought humbling self-awareness. After trying to prevent Sean from hooking up with Richard through sarcastic comments, his annoyance revealed she'd been using her gay friends as entertainment props while expecting them to keep their lives secret. Summer Showtime had created something rare, a meritocratic safe space where everyone belonged, regardless of who they loved. It was, she concluded, a pretty successful implementation of Christianity, more successful than most churches managed. Moving to Chicago in 1992 to study improv at Second City changed Fey's life, leading to Saturday Night Live and introducing her to her husband. The improv rules became life philosophies. Agree, always say yes, and accept what your partner creates. Yes and, agree and add something of your own. Make statements. Don't force your partner to provide all the answers. There are no mistakes, only opportunities. These weren't just comedy techniques. They transformed how she approached relationships, work, and creativity. Second City also exposed her to institutionalized gender nonsense. A director cut a scene saying, "The audience doesn't want to see a scene between two women." When someone suggested balancing the cast from 4 men and 2 women to 3 and 3, producers panicked. There won't be enough parts for the girls, despite creating the show themselves. Fey became that third woman in the first gender equal cast, encountering the myth of not enough, the false belief that women must compete for limited opportunities. In 1997, Fey nervously interviewed with Lorne Michaels at 30 Rock, blurting Pennsylvania when asked if she was from Chicago. She got the job anyway and learned vital lessons. Producing is about discouraging creativity, managing eager departments, not generating ideas. The show doesn't go on because it's ready. It goes on because it's 11:30. Don't overthink your writing. And crucially, don't hire anyone you wouldn't want to run into in the hallway at 3 in the morning. Her biggest revelation came fighting for Paula Pell's Kotex classic sketch. Male producers called it too difficult, asking bewildering questions about belted maxi pads. This was her aha moment. There was no institutionalized sexism. They literally didn't understand what the women were discussing. Gender differences aren't always about power. Sometimes they're about fundamentally different lived experiences. Amy Poehler transformed the room when Jimmy Fallon reacted to her vulgar joke with, "Stop that, it's not cute." Amy went cold. "I don't fucking care if you like it." A masterclass in refusing to perform femininity for male approval. After 8 SNL seasons, Faye developed a sitcom about working at a sketch comedy show, with Tracy Morgan as a lunatic star and Alec Baldwin as her conservative boss. NBC picked up the show largely because of Baldwin. The production schedule was brutal, filming each episode like a little movie, then meeting writers at her apartment until 2 a.m. while watching her sleeping daughter on a baby monitor. In 2008, John McCain selected Sarah Palin as his running mate. People immediately noticed their resemblance, just brown hair and glasses, Faye thought. Her impression became a cultural phenomenon, with the Katie Couric interview sketch using Palin's actual rambling words. The sketches were watched globally, even mistaken for reality by a French newspaper. After years performing for empty rooms, having an audience that actually wanted to see her felt like luxury, but it also taught her what it feels like to be a lightning rod. Hate mail accused her of attacking Palin, criticism male impressionists never faced. Despite 58 million online views, she wasn't paid for internet reuse, and the Palin sketches may have hurt 30 Rock by alienating half the population. Working motherhood proved treacherous. The accusatory, "How do you juggle it all?" really meant, "You're fucking it all up, aren't you?" Work brought deep satisfaction, while full-time motherhood sometimes stinks like Axe body spray on a brick of blue cheese, yet surprised her with meaningful moments holding fingernail clippings at 6 a.m. like a Santeria priestess. Her prayer for her daughter reveals everything. First, Lord, no tattoos. She prays for beauty, but not damaged. It's the damage that attracts creepy soccer coaches. She hopes for work with flexible hours, intellectual fulfillment, and no high heels. She requests a rough patch from 12 to 17, long enough to build character without lasting damage. The prayer culminates beautifully. Should her daughter become a mother, let her witness herself at 4:50 a.m. cleaning baby poop, realizing, "My mother did this for me." She'll forget to call, but her mother will know because she peeped it with God's eyes. In a world demanding women be everything to everyone, Faye offers a different path. Perfection isn't the goal. Authenticity is. Your awkwardness, your anxiety, your inability to fit sample size clothing aren't flaws to fix, but fuel for your fire. The greatest rebellion isn't becoming what they expect. It's becoming exactly who you are and laughing about it.